This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As we've learned, John Roberts, Harriet Myers, and Samuel Alito are very different people with very different records. But as President Bush declared in nominating them to the Supreme Court, they all have a conservative judicial philosophy. It comes as no surprise that President Bush nominates conservatives, but it is far from clear what a conservative judicial philosophy means. There are, it turns out, more than a few distinct conservative judicial philosophies. We'll find out more about that. And we'll try to help you decode a lot of the judicial terminology you'll be hearing over the next several weeks. Strict constructionist, for example, or judicial activist. And we'll ask how much philosophy, whether conservative, liberal, or centrist, how much philosophy has to do with being a good Supreme Court justice, or a bad one. Later in the program, young director Noah Baumbach joins us to talk about Brooklyn, Hollywood, and his new movie, The Squid and the Whale. But first, judicial philosophy. If you're a liberal, what question would you ask to determine whether a nominee has a judicial philosophy you could live with? And if you're a conservative, what does conservative judicial philosophy mean to you? And what question would you ask a nominee to see if he or she has it? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. We're joined now by Jeffrey Rosen, a law professor at George Washington University, legal affairs editor at the New Republic. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Jeffrey, always good to have you on the program.
Very nice to be here.
Originalist, constructionist, textualist, help us decipher some of these prominent schools of conservative philosophy.
Well, perhaps the most prominent, as you suggested, goes by the name of originalism and or textualism. Maybe we can just treat them together in order not to be too confusing. These are judges who believe that the Constitution should be interpreted in light of its original understanding, and they care a lot about the constitutional text and about constitutional history. Justice Scalia is the most prominent originalist, and many conservatives hope that Judge Alito will be one as well.
And as we're going along with this, how would an originalist then deal with things like the Internet?
What an excellent question. We can have a whole law school seminar on that. That's actually, there's a lot to talk about. But I think an originalist might ask, obviously not what the founders thought about the Internet, because there was no Internet, but if they were thinking about a question like the search of a computer, they would say that the founders meant to protect the sanctity of private spaces against trespass, and then they would try to translate the amendment, the Fourth Amendment, so that it took account of invasions, virtual invasions of computer and of the Internet that the founders couldn't have imagined. But the reason the question is so good is because it reminds us right away that you can't just make the one-step question of asking what the founders would have thought. Often you have to translate to account of new technologies, and that by itself involves subjective judgments that people are going to disagree a lot about.
Human nature hasn't changed, but human technology sure has.
It has indeed.
and some of these other schools, when you hear the phrase strict constructionist, what does that mean?
Not all that much. That's more of a political term that's used as a synonym for judicial conservative.
Is it the antonym of judicial activist?
No. Okay. Here's where things get confusing. Everyone has a different definition for a judicial activist. I've found the most useful one to be purely descriptive. Basically, someone is engaging in activism if they vote to strike down a law, a federal or state law.
Mm-hmm.
And if they vote to uphold it, they're being restrained. It's not saying whether the activism is good or bad. It's just very descriptive. Judged by that standards, it turns out that neither liberals nor conservatives have a monopoly on judicial activism. The most activist judge on the court is Judge Anthony Kennedy, who's voted to strike down more federal and state laws than any other justice, joined shortly after by Justice O'Connor. The most restrained judges are Breyer and Ginsburg, and Scalia and Thomas and the others are somewhere in between.
And that's not the way, if you, again, use that as a code word for judicial philosophy, that's not the way it would break out.
No. Now, usually conservatives often say activism is substituting your policy preferences for the text of the Constitution. The problem is people disagree a lot about what people's policy preferences are and what the text requires, so it might be more useful to break these out into slightly more nuanced categories.
We're talking about some of the judicial terminology and some of the judicial philosophies that will be debated over the next several weeks as first the Senate Judiciary Committee and then later the Senate, of course the country at large, debates the nomination of Samuel Alito to the United States Supreme Court. Our guest is Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University Law School. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN@NPR.org. And let's begin with Eileen. Eileen calling us from Madisonville, Kentucky.
I hear them talking about legislating from the bench. And I'm not exactly sure what they mean by that.
Me neither. Jeffrey Rosen, what do they mean by legislating from the bench?
Well, me neither, so it's a very good question. I think when President Bush uses that term, he means that judges are ignoring the text and history of the Constitution and instead substituting their policy preferences. And the kind of decisions that conservatives like to point out as examples of legislating from the bench are, of course, predominantly Roe v. Wade, which they said was not well-rooted in the text of the Constitution. And all of those decisions from the 1960s were core. Courts, for example, ordered busing or came up with very legislative-like requirements that ordered people to do various things.
Just to go a little bit more into that, the word privacy, for example, I don't think appears anywhere in the Constitution of the United States, yet the Supreme Court discerned a right to privacy inherent in the Constitution from that flowed Griswold and then Roe v. Wade on abortion.
It did, and what's so interesting about that is that John Roberts accepted that the Supreme Court has for more than 80 years protected a right to privacy. We'll see what Judge Alito does, but it now seems very difficult to get appointed to the Supreme Court, let alone confirmed, if you don't concede that the Constitution protects at least some right to privacy, even though the text doesn't mention privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that concession reminds us that precedent actually carries a lot of weight in the law. And there are very few conservatives today who will take the position that Judge Robert Bork did in 1987, saying because it's not written down in the Constitution, it's not protected.
Mm-hmm.
So figuring out what Judge Alito thinks about those precedents, which have been on the books for more than 80 years, is obviously going to be a central focus of the hearing. And trying to come up with his theory of what precedent should be retained, even when they're inconsistent with the text, is also very difficult.
If you accuse a judge of legislating from the bench, is that a code word for saying he's a liberal?
Well, for conservatives it is, but liberals happily are now using that epithet as well. And they accuse conservatives of legislating from the bench when, for example, conservatives strike down laws of Congress, prohibiting gun use, for example, that they say are not clearly forbidden by the text of the Constitution. Since Judge Alito has indeed voted to strike down the transfer and possession of machine guns on the grounds that it exceeded Congress's power,
mm-hmm.
people will accuse him of legislating from the bench, and then you just have to get down into the nitty-gritty details of what your judicial philosophy is.
Eileen, we've been chasing our tails here in the studio. I'm not sure we've helped you at all.
Well, my observation is that people complain, particularly the conservatives, complain if the court gives equal rights to some people, which the conservatives don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very confusing, I think.
Well, I think we can all agree on the confusing part.
You got
that right.
Thanks very much for the call, Eileen.
All right.
Appreciate it. Just to go back a minute, you mentioned Judge Alito's decision on a case that involved where he said machine guns weren't forbidden by the U.S. Constitution, or the law that prohibited machine guns was not permitted under the U.S. Constitution. His two colleagues disagreed with him. If you look at that in one way, it's a pro-gun decision. If you look at it another way, it's a pro-states' rights decision. He's not necessarily saying that everybody should have a machine gun. He's saying there's nothing that bars machine guns in this law or in the U.S. Constitution.
Precisely right. It depends which way you approach it. Now, it's an activist decision if you accept that neutral definition of activism I mm-hmm. offered at the beginning, because he's voting to strike down a law of Congress. And the Supreme Court, over time, has not done that very often, so that's a really big deal. But he's justifying his decision by saying that the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce, doesn't allow Congress to ban the transfer or possession of purely intrastate activities that don't have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. So those who defend the decision would say he's just following the text and original understanding of the Constitution, not legislating from the bench, and it just comes down to which philosophy you buy.
And if you would have to see if he's consistent with that philosophy, for example, in cases that involved the medical marijuana case that was decided earlier this year, or still coming up, I think, in front of the bench, is the assisted suicide law in the state of Oregon.
Very much so. It would be interesting if he were not consistent, if he made exceptions. On the other hand, you might say if he's so consistent that he will vote to strike down every congressional law that doesn't clearly fall within the commerce power, then he's a radical member of another judicial philosophy, which we haven't yet mentioned, which some people call the Constitution in exile, that he's really trying to resurrect limitations on congressional power that have been dormant for a long time. And the consistency is a sign of zeal, critics would say. His refusal to move incrementally and to respect previous precedents is a sign of radicalism. And therefore, consistency is not only the hobgoblin of little minds, but in some cases, really an indication of constitutional radicalism.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Alvin. Alvin's calling from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
New Yorker, last week or the week before, I had an article on Justice Breyer indicating that he upheld federal law much more often than the conservative justices on the Supreme Court. And it's very confusing when you listen to conservatives talking about these matters, that that they talk about not legislating from the bench and strict conservative and so on. What exactly is the conservative argument about the matter of legislating from the bench?
I'm so glad that you noticed that figure. That's a very telling figure, that Justice Breyer voted to uphold more federal laws, certainly than the conservatives. Now, conservatives would say that's only half the story, because Justice Breyer voted to strike down more state laws than, for example, Justices Scalia and Thomas. But when you add up the combination of the federal and state laws, you still find that Justice Breyer is among the most restrained judges, while Scalia and Thomas are more toward the activist bent. But you ask, what is their definition? In defense, they would say you're not legislating from the bench when you vote to strike down an act of Congress, because Congress only has the powers that are enumerated by the U.S. Constitution. We're a government of limited powers, and by enforcing limitations on governmental power that are implicit and explicit in the text of the Constitution, judges are merely doing their job.
Dr. Hawk, that's a circular reasoning, is it not?
What do you mean circular?
Well, I just mean that if, in fact, the test is what they think the Constitution says, rather than states' rights or the right of Congress to make laws, then it doesn't seem to lead anywhere.
I think you're right that it's quite subjective, and that figuring out what the Constitution clearly requires is difficult, because it doesn't clearly require an awful lot at all. So I think you're also right to suggest that rather than just focusing on platitudes about legislating from the bench, ask how deferential a judge really is. That's what you did when you cited that very informative statistic.
Yes.
And judged by that standard, it turns out that liberals like Justice Breyer are more deferential, by and large, than their conservative colleagues.
Thanks for the call, Alvin.
Thank you.
We're talking about the Supreme Court and taking your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. What makes a good Supreme Court justice? Is it philosophy, or is it, something else? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Supreme Court justices and judicial philosophy. Later on in the program, we'll chat with Noah Baumbach, the director of the new movie The Squid and the Whale. Our guest is Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University. If you're a liberal, what question would you ask to determine whether a nominee has a judicial philosophy you could live with? If you're a conservative, what does conservative judicial philosophy mean to you? And what question would you ask a nominee to see if he or she has it? 800-989-8255, or email us, totn@npr.org. Let's talk with Nathan. Nathan calling us from Salt Lake City.
Oh.
Yes, Nathan?
Ah, Neil, you there?
Yes, we are. You're on the air.
Okay, great. My question, I think, to any person being appointed to the Supreme Court would be, do you value liberty more, or do you value order more in your daily decision-making process?
What might that reveal, Jeffrey Rosen?
Great question. It's so simple that one wishes that some of the senators had asked it. That's a very nice way of putting it. Liberty versus order would raise all sorts of revealing things about how a justice approaches questions involving searches and seizures, involving the power of the president to detain enemy combatants, the scope of executive authority. These are all very live questions. It would be especially interesting to ask Nathan's question to Judge Alito, because, of course, he was a former prosecutor, and he would be one of the only justices, I think the only one with extensive experience in criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
Some of his defenders say that this makes him more skeptical of the soft underbelly of the government's case. He won't accept things on face value. Others think he'd be very deferential to the police, but just allowing him to reflect broadly on that question would be great. Another reason the question is so good is we've just seen that there's a report that Judge Alito wrote as a Princeton student about the right to privacy and the balance between privacy and security, in which, in very philosophical and terms evoking John Stuart Mill, he talks about gay rights and about computer privacy and all sorts of things that strike the balance between liberty and order. So I think he'd have an awful lot of interesting things to say about that.
And if a nominee edged towards liberty, would you call him a liberal, and toward order a conservative?
Not necessarily, because he might be a libertarian, as we know that there are many conservatives who value liberty more highly than anything else. They are willing to strike down lots of laws to protect liberty, and they often join with civil libertarian liberals in questions involving national security and post 9/11 detentions, because they are concerned about imposing limits on unbridled executive authority.
Nathan, I hope we cleared that up for you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. In his September confirmation hearings, now Chief Justice John Roberts couched his judicial philosophy in terms of baseball.
I will be open to the considered views of my colleagues on the bench, and I will decide every case based on the record, according to the rule of law, without fear or favor, to the best of my ability. And I will remember that it's my job to call balls and strikes and not to pitch or bat.
Well, to look into this analogy a little further, we're joined now by Robert Schwartz, a lawyer and executive director of the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia, also a former baseball umpire. He comes to us from the studios of member station WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, home to the Harrisburg Senators of the Eastern League. And good to have you on the program, sir.
Great to be on the program.
The rules of baseball are pretty clearly written down, and in terms of what umpires are allowed to decide upon, strike, ball, fair, foul, safe, out, an umpire doesn't seem to have an awful lot of wiggle room there.
Well, it was actually the presence of wiggle room that got me to thinking about the comparisons between judges and umpires. There's a lot more wiggle room than now Chief Justice Roberts suggested in his remarks before the Senate. In fact, even the way one calls balls and strikes or interprets whether a batter swings or doesn't swing depends on one's approach to the game, one's interpretation, and how those calls have been made in the past by umpires who have preceded you in the same league.
So there are umpiric philosophies?
There are umpiric philosophies.
I'm sorry.
In fact, Ron Luciano once wrote a book called The Umpire Strikes Back, so there are lots of plays on that word.
Mm-hmm. you'd think even something as simple as safe out. Well, as everybody knows, there's something in baseball called the neighborhood play, when the second baseman is trying to turn the pivot on a double play and doesn't necessarily exactly step on second base in an effort to stay away from a sliding runner. More or less, if you're in the neighborhood, you're out.
And that's particularly true the higher up in baseball that you go, the more professional the players are. When you're umpiring a Little League game or a high school game, the neighborhood rule doesn't apply quite as much. But the rules of interpretation change in different venues.
Did you ever feel that as an umpire you overstepped your boundaries, or were you a strict constructionist?
Well, sometimes I was a strict constructionist when it worked for me.
you were a pragmatist.
I was, and of course there were times when you spent time trying to figure out the intent of the framers of the rules. There were plenty of examples in my own sort of limited career, which got as far as college and semi-pro baseball, that required me to figure out what was the purpose of the rule. Mm-hmm. And quite often strict construction just didn't apply at all. And in fact, it does it now in many areas of umpiring.
There are even some fairly obscure rules that there's a lot of interpretation. The infield fly rule, for example, sounds pretty simple, but where does the infield begin and where does the outfield end?
Well, it's not only that, which is an important part of interpreting the rule, but whether or not an infielder can make the catch with ordinary effort. What's ordinary effort? That's the kind of judgment that umpires make all the time. It's written in the rule book. I'm not sure whether umpires who make the infield fly call are legislating from the bench or are judicial activists or strict constructionists when they're trying to figure out what the word ordinary means. But that's the kind of work that judges and, in particular, justices do all the time when doing constitutional interpretation, because words like ordinary appear quite often in the Constitution.
Well, we've been having some fun with this, but I wonder, I mean, did you see this analogy playing out in Supreme Court cases?
Well, it plays out all the time, and I think that it's already played out in the discussion that you've had with Professor Rosen and some of the callers. The difficulty of figuring out what it means to be an activist and to get past the bumper sticker slogans of legislating from the bench or strictly applying the law. In truth, and I think Professor Rosen has laid this out very clearly, there are areas that require interpretation, and the question is what kind of interpretation you're using. We're seeing that in the Commerce Clause cases that that he cited, 11th Amendment interpretation that you might want to go into, which has been radically rewritten by conservative jurists in surprising ways that have nothing to do with the original text. And then, of course, there's the congressional power under the 14th Amendment, whether Congress has power to enforce the laws implied by the amendment. So this does come up all the time. And I was struck that the analogy to umpiring was made by a nominee of a president who's a former owner of a baseball team.
Yeah.
And now we have a nominee who once wanted to be a baseball commissioner, if you read the local Philadelphia papers. In fact, there was a nice picture of him the other day in his Philadelphia Phillies uniform when he went to fantasy camp.
Maybe I was going to say maybe the definition is as if a conservative wanted to be the baseball commissioner and a liberal wanted to play second base. But maybe that's just sequential and it could be the generation gap. I don't know anything about that. Robert Schwartz, thanks very much for being with us today.
Great being with you, Neil.
Robert Schwartz is a lawyer and executive director of the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia and a former baseball umpire, and he joined us from the studios of member station WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We're asking listeners to come up with questions to define a potential Supreme Court justice's judicial philosophy. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email is totn@npr.org. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is James. James calling us from Des Moines.
Yes. My question would be, do they believe that the Constitution is to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority?
Jeffrey Rosen, the Constitution seems to be set up, at least in part, to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority.
It is indeed, although, of course, liberals and conservatives disagree strongly about which minorities deserve special protection. Conservatives are more interested in protecting property rights, for example, against legislatures that want to exercise the power of eminent domain, liberals in protecting racial and religious minorities. It's also the case that some conservatives and liberals believe that over time the court has not been especially counter-majoritarian, but has tended instead to follow the wishes of national majorities. And on the occasions when it doesn't do that, it's gotten slapped back. So asking that sort of question to a nominee, do you believe that this is the purpose of the Supreme Court, would be very interesting indeed as well.
Good question, James.
Well, my follow-up would be then, where would we be in the education system if we didn't have Brown v. Board of Education decided? Or where would we be in the question of the right to an attorney and the right to confront your accuser if we didn't have Griswold and that stream of...
Well, James, I think your phone ran out there right at the end, but Jeffrey Rosen?
You know, it's the kind of question that is fascinating to talk about right now. It's hard for Supreme Court nominees to talk about it candidly, but there are those who say that actually it wasn't Brown versus Board of Education that was the engine behind racial equality in the country. It really took the Civil Rights Movement and eventually the involvement of Congress in the Civil Rights Acts of 64 and 65 to make meaningful desegregation a reality. But that is the kind of thing that's awkward to talk about in a confirmation mm-hmm. hearing, and we'd probably expect a nominee to say, yes, indeed, the court really is necessary to save minorities from the excesses of the majority.
To continue our analogy, Jackie Robinson, of course. But here's an email we got from Ted. A good judge, he writes, is like a good rabbi. The quality of the interpretation of the Constitution depends more on the wisdom of the interpreter than it does on the words of the Constitution.
The mind is reeling with the analogies that are raised by the Jewish approach to the Constitution, which I'm all for in theory. But the idea, one difference, though, is the Talmudic tradition does put a great deal of weight on the temperament and wisdom of individual interpreters, and I think is less focused on the original understanding of the text. I should say I'm way out of my league here. I'm embarrassed to confess. Whereas a strict constructionist, in any event, are less inclined to lionize the great and wise judge. Justice Scalia often says we don't want judges to be wise in making good policy decisions that are in the interests of the country. They should do what the law says and let the heavens fall. So it's really a very... Justice Scalia is not a Talmudic scholar, perhaps, and contrasting those two things, I think, is worth at least many law review articles, if not a good book. So, so good question.
More Madison than Maimonides.
From Moshe to...
Melvin Yourofsky is a professor of law and public policy at Virginia Commonwealth University, editor of the Journal of Supreme Court History. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Very, very nice of you to join in and be willing to put up with us.
Nice to be here, Neil.
You're a scholar of Justice Louis Brandeis, who served from 1916 to 1939. He's widely recognized as one of the greatest Supreme Court justices ever. What was it, in terms of judicial philosophy, did he have a distinct one? And did he succeed by staying with it or going away from it?
I think he had a distinct philosophy, but it's not one that can easily be expressed like he did. He was a constructionist, or he believed in... He believed in judicial restraint. He believed that legislation should be left to legislatures. But he also believed in protecting individual rights. And it was he who came up with the doctrine of incorporation, essentially, that applied the Fourth Amendment, or applied the Bill of Rights, through the 14th Amendment to the states as well as the federal government. But I think what makes a really great judge is one who, A, knows the law, and B, is able to articulate that in terms of the needs of the people at the time.
Huh, needs of the people at the time. I mean, some would argue the Constitution is beyond time.
I'm not one of those.
Okay. In other words, public opinion, broadly read.
No, not necessarily public opinion. In fact, I think public opinion is the last thing that the court needs to really take into account. But times change. William O. Douglas once, in commenting on a case about wiretapping, said, what did the founders know about wiretapping? They didn't even have phones. Yet clearly wiretapping is a major concern of the Fourth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So that Brandeis is one of the first, and this I think is one of parts of his greatness, to understand that the new age, if you will, an age of telephone, radios, automobiles, was much different from the horse and buggy era of the 1780s. And in the Olmsted opinion, which dealt with wiretapping, in which the constitutional right of privacy was raised for the first time, he talked about what the founders meant in the Fourth Amendment and applied it to modern times. And although that was dissent, it has in fact become the law over the last 80 years.
We're talking about judicial philosophy and how that translates into whether you're a good justice or a bad one. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And if you could look at some of the other justices, both those who are accorded, you know, this belief of being either accepted as pretty good or accepted as maybe not so good. Again, how does philosophy play into that judgment? Or is it simply a matter of getting, you know, caught out of time in some respects?
In some respects, it is. You can have some judges who will write maybe just one opinion for which they will be remembered. Sometimes that's bad. Taney and Dred Scott, he was a man who was otherwise quite a good judge. But all we remember him for is what he wrote in the Dred Scott opinion. I think that part of it is, can you state what the law is in a way that will make sense to other justices, to the public, and have precedential value? Because if you can't articulate what your philosophy of law is, what you believe the law should be, then you don't do one of the things that Brandeis thought was very important, a very important function of a Supreme Court justice, to educate both the public and the lower bar. And no one was better at that than he was.
Hmm. Education is not a function of that court that we often think about.
It is, though. I've heard Justice Kennedy speak very eloquently about the educational role of justices in trying to get not just the other members of the judiciary, but the public to understand. If you read his opinion in the flag burning case, where he says, this is hard, I don't like what I'm doing, but it has to be done, and then he goes and explains why. And that's an educational function. He is one of the first to admit that.
Jeffrey, here's an email we got. We're asking for questions for potential nominees right along those lines. My question, writes Damon in Minneapolis, would be, please tell me about a case you decided and how it was just and constitutional but utterly against your personal beliefs. And he suggests there is a wrong answer. I can't think of one.
I so agree with that. That was Damon. I think that's my test as well. It's the most revealing one. It's Felix Frankfurter's test. He always said that he felt most principled when he just had to grit his teeth and reach a result that he abhorred, because that was a sign that he was really being principled. He was literally restraining himself. He was binding himself because of his judicial philosophy not to enact his personal preferences. What's so great about the question, I've asked that to some lower court judges. I won't say which ones. I'm always struck by how rarely they're able to come up with some very good examples. And the examples they come up with will often be laws that you suspect they really don't mind all that much anyway. Now, Professor Yourofsky just gave a good example for Justice Kennedy, flag burning. We assume he doesn't like flag burning, but the First Amendment is kind of an area where people are able to protect the rights of dissenters without upsetting themselves too much. Naming a congressional statute that struck down that the judge doesn't like would be very interesting. So thanks to Damon for that excellent insight.
When we come back from a short break, more on qualifications and judicial philosophy. We're talking about the Supreme Court, of course. And later on, we'll talk with independent film director Noah Baumbach. I'm Neil Conan. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about judicial philosophy and Supreme Court nominees and justices. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Jeffrey Rosen, who's a professor of law at George Washington University and legal affairs editor at The New Republic. Also with us here in Studio 3A is Melvin Yourofsky, editor of the Journal of Supreme Court History. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Brett. Brett's calling us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was just curious to get some insight. Being that the framers of the Constitution actually allowed for amendments, which would essentially completely rewrite any wording, possibly, I was wondering how a justice could really form a strict constructionalist view of the Constitution.
In other words, your question to a nominee might be, is the Constitution a living document or not?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Jeffrey?
Well, a strict constructionist would say it's precisely because the people have the power to amend the Constitution through the amendment process that judges shouldn't take it upon themselves to update it or interpret it in a living way, because that usurps the people's right to govern themselves. That's the short answer. The counter to that, of course, is it's very hard to amend the Constitution, and the people may believe something but not be able to work through the hurdles of Congress and ratification, and therefore judges can both take account of the people's fundamental views by not being entirely rigid in their interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very difficult to amend the Constitution, Mr. Yourofsky.
Yes, it is. And one would also argue that the words of the Constitution are not quite as plain as the textualists would have us believe. One of the examples I always use in my course is that during the Washington administration, the question of whether or not the president could issue a proclamation of neutrality came up. And he got a whole host of conflicting advisory opinions from Alexander Hamilton, who was at the Constitution, from Thomas Jefferson, who wasn't, from James Madison, who was, and of course Washington was there himself. So if the founders weren't quite sure what the words meant within a half a dozen years after writing the Constitution, certainly there's a lot of, I think, wiggle room was the word that was used before.
All right. Brett, thanks very much for the question.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Rodney. Rodney calling from San Francisco.
Hi. My question is sort of the flip side of the topic of the show today, which is, over the history of the Supreme Court, have there been just thought of as bad justices, and if so, what made them bad?
Mm-hmm. Melvin Yourofsky, you're the historian.
The only name that clearly comes to mind is Whitaker, who I think was pretty bad and went off the bench because he couldn't handle the work. We haven't had any corrupt justices. We haven't had total incompetence. We haven't had anyone who was crooked, at least insofar as the judicial process itself was concerned. Abe Fortas was forced off the bench, but not for the work that he was doing as a justice. For the most part, I think presidents have taken very seriously the fact that the people they appoint to the high court will very often be there long after they have left office. And from George Washington on, they have, I think, taken great pride in the quality of the people they have appointed. There are, follow up on that, there are, of course, justices who are thought of as not as, quote, good or great or competent as others, but no bad justices, per se.
Not even, you mentioned Justice Taney. I mean, that Dred Scott decision looks just awful.
It does. But if you take a look, Taney was there for, 30 years, just about, and he wrote an awful lot of very good opinions that still are considered good opinions.
Rodney, thanks very much.
Thanks.
And let's see if we get one last caller in on this question, and this will be Tim. Tim calling us from St. Louis.
Hi, Neil. You opened your show with a comment that it's no surprise that Bush selected a conservative judge, and you've talked about conservative judicial philosophy. Is there a liberal judicial philosophy, and do those terms mean the same thing that they do in the political arena? And probably, more appropriately, should they even be used these days? You talked just a second ago about a judge making a decision that goes against his personal beliefs. Shouldn't conservative and liberal be removed from a description of a judge?
Jeffrey?
Very good question. We could have a whole other show on what the various liberal philosophies
are. We'll give you 45 seconds to answer.
45 seconds. Whether you call them liberal perfectionists or fundamentalists, as Cass Sunstein does in a new book, there's a kind of judge led by William Brennan and Thurgood Marshall who believe that the Constitution should be as good, as perfect as it can be. And they want to interpret the great phrases involving equality and human dignity broadly to make those ideals a reality. There are no justices on the current court who qualify as liberal perfectionists or fundamentalists, but you're quite right that to talk about liberal and conservative in the sense of judicial philosophy is not the same as political one. Take, for example, pragmatists. We can think of liberal and conservative pragmatists who believe that the Constitution should be interpreted in light of its practical consequences in making government work. Both Justice Breyer and Justice O'Connor are considered pragmatists. One is far more liberal than the other, therefore it's more useful to discuss their pragmatism than their politics.
Professor Yourofsky, let me ask you, I mean, when you're teaching in school, do you use these terms?
No, I don't, because I don't think they're really applicable anymore. If you want, one of the examples I like to use is when Roosevelt, after the court fight, mm-hmm. 1937.
Packing the court.
And then he was able to name 8 people to the court. Now, every single one of them was, quote, a liberal in terms of the economic philosophy of the time. And within 2 or 3 years, that economic philosophy, as far as the agenda of the Supreme Court was concerned, was no longer applicable. We began to enter the era of civil rights and civil liberties about which these people had no prior record that you could qualify them as liberal or conservative. I think it's a political shorthand that really is used more to obscure what people may or may not be than to really help us understand their philosophy.
Melvin Yourofsky, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time. He's a professor of law and public policy at Virginia Commonwealth University, editor of the Journal of Supreme Court History, and we would also like to thank Jeffrey Rosen for coming in today. Jeffrey Rosen, a law professor at George Washington University and legal affairs editor at the New Republican. Both were kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Coming up, the squid and the whale.